I would like to reserve 3 minutes for a rebuttal, please. Good morning, Your Honors. Victor T. Owens, registration 40353, here on behalf of Mr. Terry Wayne Loader. We are here today to determine whether or not the district court erred when it denied the defendant's CRIMP 35C motion for post-conviction relief following an evidentiary hearing. We are here to determine whether the district court abused its discretion when it found that trial counsels did not provide deficient performance resulting in prejudice when they failed to raise the defense of voluntary intoxication or request a jury instruction on voluntary intoxication. The crime scene, the discovery, the record, and narrative showed that all the people involved and all the people that hung out at DB Studios, they all used a lot of alcohol and they all did a lot of drugs. And considering this, it's defense counsel's duty to present this information to the jury because it was Mr. Loader's best chance at negating the specific intent required to obtain a conviction for first-degree murder.
Well, let me ask you, Mr. Owens, what's the basis for saying it was his best chance? I suppose that goes to prejudice. I mean, here we have a situation where there was choice of possible defenses. Defense counsel chose to pursue a strategy of this was a defense against a sexual assault, which both defense counsel, 16 years after the fact, testified that seemed to fit the facts better. Don't they get to make that strategic choice, and don't we have to defer to that strategic choice?
No, you don't, Your Honor. The strategic choice pursued by counsel was ineffective. Respectfully, Your Honor, I submit that the defense completely failed to present a cohesive, coherent narrative by depriving the jury of the true story, of depriving the jury of the facts that provided sense to the terrible crime scene and the sordid events.
Mr. Owens, I'm not clear now about your argument. I thought your argument was that the trial defense attorneys were ineffective because they didn't also present the defense of voluntary intoxication. Are you now saying that they shouldn't have at all presented the issue of the sex assault as a defense during the trial?
No, what I'm saying is that the defense they presented was part and parcel of the entire story. It did not provide the detail required. It did not provide the full story of what occurred. By not pursuing the defense of voluntary intoxication, the jury here heard all of this information from the prosecution expert about homosexual rage and its connection to drug usage, and it heard nothing about how its counterparts, cocaine and methamphetamines, were missing from the incident.
Mr. Owens,
they were present.
Excuse me, I'm sorry to interrupt, but
yes,
did the trial court make findings about how that there might be reasonable strategic choices to leave the drug use out of the evidence and just focus on the sexual assault issue?
Well, the district court's findings are incorrect because there was no valid strategic reason why defense counsel would fail to request a jury instruction or pursue a voluntary intoxication defense.
Well, I think the trial court identified a strategic reason. Are you saying that that wasn't valid?
It was not valid, not at all, because the arguments were completely complementary. It was part and parcel of the entire theme of the defense. The prosecution presented all this information about overkilling. It was clearly an overkilling crime scene. The coroner and the prosecution expert agreed upon that. And overkilling is known to be accompanied with methamphetamine and cocaine use, as well as homosexual rage. They only presented a half of the story. They did not present what they needed to present. Moreover, voluntary intoxication, it went directly to the mens rea of the defendant, and it negated the specific intent required for first-degree murder.
Let me ask you, Mr. Owens, you said that the defenses were complementary. I guess I need some help with that. If they pursued a voluntary intoxication defense, that would negate, as you just said, the mens rea. Wouldn't that be completely inconsistent with a defense of self-defense? Because for self-defense, you concede that you did the act, and you say, I did it, but I was justified. Aren't those things inconsistent?
They're not inconsistent. They're complementary in the sense where there's different levels of mens rea that need to be proven to establish both things. So to establish first-degree murder, they have to establish the specific intent. Putting forth that argument would not have lessened the defense of self-defense. It would have added to the story. It would have made the jury say, okay, I actually can understand what is happening more. The jury heard that these people were all up at 3 in the morning, that all of this activity was occurring, but they had nothing to put it into context. This would not have at all contradicted. It was absolutely ineffective for counsel to fail to present the story. And there was significant evidence already within the record regarding intoxication. There's more than adequate information within the record to already obtain a jury instruction on voluntary intoxication, regardless of whether or not they even continue to pursue the defense.
Can I ask you to address Strickland then, and the presumption that there was reasonable strategic judgments here? You're making a compelling and zealous argument, which I respect and appreciate.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The problem is, you may be right. There's plenty of evidence they could have pursued that. Here, though, we have they testified. We have a hearing. Counsel testified. We made a choice. We thought this self-defense fit the facts better. And so even if you are completely right, there was substantial evidence would have supported voluntary intoxication. How, 20 years after the fact, can we say that was, I think you're asking us to find as a matter of law, this was strategically improper. And I'm not seeing how we can square that with Strickland. So could you address that?
You can absolutely find it. The deficient performance resulting in prejudice here, I'm sorry, could you summarize that real quick?
And I apologize. It was a long question, my fault. I'm just asking you to help me out with Strickland. I accept your argument. There was a lot of evidence here that would have supported voluntary intoxication. It seems like we're facing a different question, really, based, I suppose, on standard of review and where we are.
As far as investigation, what they decided to pursue was the only reason they pursued that because it was a result of ineffective assistance and ineffective investigation. They did not do a full and complete investigation into discovery, into the records, into the witnesses, into the statements provided when choosing their defense. And yes, they said they went ahead and they consulted with an expert. Well, she didn't review any of the discovery, and they relied upon her information when determining whether or not they were going to pursue a mental health defense. It's completely irrational and illogical, and it was ineffective.
Mr. Owens, what do we do with the fact that the trial judge here concluded that your expert at the evidentiary hearing was not credible?
Well, I would submit to Your Honor that my expert was incredibly credible. Your Honor, he's an Olam Award winner. He's been practicing for over 15 years. He worked with the public defenders for a significant amount of time. He's had success in the Court of Appeals, Supreme Court, district courts across the state. And he fully reviewed the record, which is much more than the defense expert did.
Well, I guess the problem, if any one of us were sitting as the trial court judge, we might come to a different conclusion about credibility. But the problem is that we weren't sitting as the trial court judge. The trial court made a call on the credibility of witnesses, and aren't we bound by that credibility determination?
Well, you're bound based upon what is supported by the record. And here, what do we have within the record? We don't have support for that. What we have is a qualified expert, an Olam Award winner, testifying that there was both ineffective assistance and prejudice, who found that there was no valid strategic reason for not raising the argument, even if they in requesting the jury instruction. And he found that there was absolutely prejudice because the key point of possibly getting around after deliberation, the jury wasn't instructed that they could have considered the fairly substantial evidence of intoxication on that point. It's not supported by the record. The Krimke 35C evidentiary hearing does not provide the evidence for the district court to rely upon. It's not supported. It was an abuse of discretion. Furthermore, if you look at the testimony of trial counsels, both trial counsels testified, we have no specific recollection. We have no specific recollection. We don't even remember intoxication in discovery. There was 10 different reports and statements within discovery. He said, I did it. I did it when I was on crane. He said, I did it when I was on methamphetamines. His cousin, Fidel Lozano, He looked like he was on something when he came over. He saw them before and after the incident. He looked like he was on something, walking across his living room, eyes wide open, pacing. He even said, "Hey, what's going on? Are you on something?" He said, "I'm a Terry Wayne Loader High." And then he also provided a statement that Mr. Loader is known to use crank and methamphetamines. And this is further supported by the information within the record. Mr. Loader told Kathina Gregory that he was intoxicated from crank when he did it. Joanna Gregory, her sister, and Mr. Loader's ex-girlfriend said, "You know, Mr. Loader, he smokes crank, pot, and coke." Fidel Lozano saw him afterwards, said he was all wired up, and he looked like he was on something. They even asked him, "Hey, what do you want?" And he said, "Hey, I used abuse," and they took that to mean alcohol.
But wasn't there also evidence, Mr. Owens, of your own guy saying, I wasn't on drugs?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And
so why don't we have a fact issue here, you know, where somebody's got to make a strategic call?
Because, Your Honor, as far as that is concerned, what he said before and after, he was under the influence. Mr. Loader had a history of using methamphetamines and cocaine. Further, these drugs' effects generally last from 6 to 8 hours. They can go up to 24 hours. In fact, if you look for signs of methamphetamine use on the internet, one of the things to look for is people who have been up for days at a time. Days at a time. I'm sure if a jury heard this information, it's reasonably likely that it could have affected and changed their minds.
So it has to be, and I know you want to save time for rebuttal. You're coming up on the 3-minute mark. I'll make this quick. Would you address prejudice for me? You've said it's reasonably likely, I guess, the result would have been different. There was a lot of evidence here, pre-deliberation as well. So what's the basis for saying there's a reasonable probability the result would have been different if they pursued voluntary intoxication?
Well, for starters, the record shows that the expert who testified in this case and was qualified as an expert believes so. And the key point is that the defense failed to provide the jury with the information that they needed to, and the mechanism to deal with all of this intoxication evidence within the record. They couldn't do anything with it. They didn't have a jury instruction. They got all this testimony about overkilling, methamphetamine use, but they weren't told about it. If they were told about the methamphetamine being in connection to the overkilling that night with assorted events, then it's likely that they would say, "Okay, this makes sense. I can see how, you know, he couldn't form that reasonable state of mind. It just makes it seem like they were all there, they're coherent, it's 3 a.m, they're getting along great, and then this happens."
You got about 2.5, just so you know.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll reserve the rest.
Good morning. May it please the court. William Kozlowski, registration number 37824, on behalf of the people. As this court's well aware, defendant has to establish both deficient performance and prejudice. And as the trial court found, he failed to do either of them. Defendant has to show that not only that the trial counsel's decisions was better or could have been better, but that their decision was incompetent, that the proposed course of action that he now espouses was so unquestionably better that no competent attorney would have undertaken that action. Both counsel, and particularly lead counsel Mr. Hansen, testified that they did not pursue the intoxication defense because it was not prominent in discovery, it was not suggested by the facts, and it wasn't consistent with the narrative of the case as they presented it. That narrative being that there was a provoking act that negated the after deliberation element of first degree murder.
Can you have intoxication in combination with a provoking act?
I think you can. They're not inconsistent in that one defeats the other, but under the facts of this case, they just weren't presented. The theory that defense counsel presented was that Mr. Loader was there and that the victim either threatened him with a sexual assault or there was an implication that maybe he just propositioned him and that Mr. Loader violently reacted to that. There was no set of facts where he was also intoxicated and that was the reason he was incapable of of deliberating, essentially.
Well, if intoxication is not inconsistent with the defense that was presented, wouldn't it be reasonable or deficient performance of counsel did not present that evidence for the jury to consider?
Well, I think the answer is it's not necessarily inconsistent. Under the facts of this case, it is inconsistent. Because under the defense's theory, they attempted to discredit the Lozanos, who testified that the defendant came over and said, "I'm gonna go do the victim, are you down?" And he was picking up knives, and then he came back covered in blood and said, "I told you I was going to do it. I was a man of my word." So it's difficult for a defense counsel to say, "Oh, you shouldn't believe that part, but believe their testimony about him being wide-eyed and pacing and such." So you can't. It's difficult for a defense, if not impossible, for a defense counsel to say, "Oh, you should believe this part of their testimony, but not this part of their testimony."
Mr. Kozlowski, while you pause, let me ask you a question that always troubles me in cases like this, and that's kind of, where is the line, or how much does the defendant have to show to establish strategic choice? Now here, and again, I understand 16 years after the trial, law counsel won't have a whole lot of memory of what they chose to do. Now, I know Strickland talks about we have to presume strategic choices. How much does the defense have to prove? That's a hypothetical situation. I know these weren't your facts, but say defense counsel say, trial was 16 years ago. I can't for the life of me remember why I chose this defense over that. Do we presume strategic choice in that? Is that enough? In other words, I'm trying to get to where's the line. And here we have a little more there. I really don't remember, one of the counsel said, but my process was always, my practice was to always, run down mental mens rea defenses.
Right. I think a defense attorney saying that would not be enough to establish deficient performance, because the defendant bears the burden of proving an objectively unreasonable action by defense counsel. And the starting point is it was made in the process of reasonable strategic decisions. So unless there's affirmative proof that overcomes that, I don't think that gets there. Him merely saying, "I don't remember why I did this," doesn't move the ball past. It was done for an unreasonable reason.
But what else could a defense counsel do in that situation? The defense lawyers are the ones who made the choice, after the fact, and they say, "I don't remember." I mean, what else could they possibly, are they just dead in the water?
Yeah. I mean, the Supreme Court says it's defendant's burden, and he has to overcome the burden of what Strickland says. And if the proof is lacking there, that's just his problem.
So would the proof be an expert who says that just wasn't a reasonable strategic choice? Is that?
I mean, I think in a case such as this, if the facts fit the situation, you would say if you had all of discovery and you had all of the evidence at trial, you could construct a hypothetical where there is no reason you would ever do this, or not do this, I guess you would say.
All right, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Moving on to prejudice, I think I'd just like to go over what evidence the defendant says supports a intoxication defense in this case.
Mr. Kozlowski, if I may interrupt you, before you get to the evidence regarding prejudice, I'd like to ask you, what do we do about the fact that the trial court stated the incorrect standard for prejudice in its order, and you concede that in your brief?
The first, at the beginning of the prejudice analysis, he correctly stated it and said it. Defendant failed to prove a reasonable probability and then misstated it at the end.
Right, I understand you said that in your brief as well, but
right.
If the trial court said the correct standard first and then the incorrect standard, how do we know whether the trial court relied on the correct standard or the incorrect standard?
Well, it doesn't matter because your review is de novo, so no matter what standard the trial court used, you can review it in the first instance, and using the correct standard, the defendant fails to meet that standard.
Okay, now you can explain to us why you think so.
First of all, there was overwhelming evidence of defendant's guilt in this case. After the murder, he essentially told everyone, his girlfriend, his girlfriend's friend, that he had done it. And before he stated what he was going to do, when he got back to the Lozano's house, he was cleaning himself off, told them he was going to go make it look like a robbery, hides his clothes, gets rid of the murder weapon, and tells his girlfriend he's going to try and run, and he thinks he got rid of all the fingerprints at the scene. So all of that evidence, which was basically not disputed at trial, an intoxication defense would not negate anything to do with that evidence. And also, the evidence in the record regarding intoxication was very weak. As I said about the Lozanos, they testified he was wide-eyed and acting strange, but he specifically denied he was using drugs, and they never saw him use drugs. He told his girlfriend, Miss Gregory, that he had abuse, which she thought meant he used alcohol, but he also told her at the same time that he killed the victim because the victim was talking about his family and other people and that he needed to flee. He told the friend, Miss Agostino, that he was intoxicated during the murder, but he also told her that when he essentially said the victim was talking smack to him and he gave him a few chances and then walked up behind him and slid him from one ear to the other and stabbed him. So once again, it's hard to say, oh, he was intoxicated, but it wasn't after deliberation when part of the same statement is completely inconsistent with the chosen theory of defense. Defendant said he had a beer and some marijuana with the victim. The coroner testified that there was no marijuana in the victim's system, so that doesn't move the ball very much. And the police expert testifying that a crime scene like this was consistent with meth use. I think that went more to rebutting the defendant's theory. Defendant presented the theory as this crime scene is consistent with homosexual rage and overkill. And I think the prosecution just presented this as it's also consistent with other things, not necessarily that was what occurred. And defense counsel today relies much on cocaine and methamphetamine. While there was certainly evidence that could have been presented that he was a known methamphetamine and cocaine user, I'm fairly certain there's no evidence in the record that someone could have testified that he was on methamphetamine or cocaine that evening. And if the court has no further questions, I ask you to affirm the order denying defendant's post-conviction motion. Thank you.
Mr. Owens.
It matters. It all matters. There was no valid strategic reason not to request the jury instruction. It would have been granted. There was tons of information within the record to support an intoxication defense. This is first-degree murder, and counsels failed to present an affirmative defense. An affirmative defense that would change the burden of proof, and the prosecution would have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the affirmative defense was inapplicable. Counsel already conceded it was applicable. Furthermore, the quantum of evidence required is a scintilla of evidence. They should have requested the jury instruction. They would have gotten it. It would have made a difference. In this case, the district court abused its discretion. There was no objective, reasonable justification for not raising voluntary intoxication. The facts, record, and circumstances demanded that defense counsel raise the defense, and there was no valid strategic reason why they failed to present an available meritorious defense which negated the specific intent required to obtain a conviction for first-degree murder. The record and information presented at the post-conviction hearing established both that trial counsel was ineffective, resulting in prejudice, and this is corroborated by the CRIMP 35C expert, the testimony of trial counsels, the prosecution expert presented at the trial who testified regarding overkilling and the connection to methamphetamines. In addition, the reliance upon the court and counsels on the expert who failed to review discovery is illogical and cannot be allowed. It's unjust, and the district court abused its discretion. Therefore, based on the arguments presented here and submitted briefs, we respectfully request that this court reverse the decision of the district court and remand the matter back for a new trial.
Thank you, Mr. Owens.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel for your arguments. They've been very helpful, and we very much appreciate the time that you spend on these cases. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.
Thank you.